Welcome to SCOTUSCast, certifiably eligible edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 23, 2010, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Shady Grove Orthopedic Associates versus Allstate Insurance. The question in this case was whether a New York state law precluded a federal district court in a diversity case from entertaining a class action under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia, the court held that because Rule 23 clearly authorized a class action in this case, it governed here, notwithstanding the New York law, unless it exceeded the Rules Enabling Act or Congress's rulemaking power. The court further ruled, in a plurality opinion by Justice Scalia and a concurring opinion by Justice Stevens, that Rule 23 validly applied here. Beyond that, the court divided in several ways over the relationship between Rule 23, the New York law, the Rules Enabling Act, and Erie v. Tompkins, with no opinion commanding a majority of the court. To discuss the case, we have George Mason University School of Law Professor Jonathan F. Mitchell. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Mitchell.
Hi, this is Jonathan Mitchell, and I'm here to discuss the Supreme Court's recent decision in Shady Grove Orthopedic Associates against Allstate Insurance Company. The court issued its ruling on March 31st, 2010, and it's a decision that didn't make a lot of newspaper headlines. But the case presents some delicate and fascinating questions of statutory interpretation and federalism. It's also a case where the justices divided 5-4, but in an unusual alignment. Justices Stevens and Sotomayor joined Justices Scalia and Thomas and the Chief Justice in forming the 5-justice majority in this case. So the issues in Shady Grove cut across the usual ideological fault lines that we see on the Roberts Court. The facts of the case are straightforward. One of Allstate's insureds suffered injuries in an automobile accident, and she received treatment from Shady Grove Orthopedic Associates. As partial payment for her medical care, the patient assigned to Shady Grove the insurance benefits that she would have received under her Allstate policy. Shady Grove then demanded that Allstate pay the assigned benefits. New York insurance law required Allstate to either fork out the money or deny the claim within 30 days. But Allstate paid Shady Grove's claim only after the 30-day window expired, and then it refused to pay the $500 in statutory interest that it owed Shady Grove because of this delay. So Shady Grove then sued Allstate in federal district court, alleging state law, breach of contract, and bad faith claims. Of course, the amount in controversy between Shady Grove and Allstate was merely $500, well below the $75,000 amount in controversy requirement for diversity jurisdiction. So to satisfy the amount in controversy, Shady Grove asked the district court to certify a class action on behalf of all other entities to whom Allstate owed statutory interest under New York law. Now, the issue for the Supreme Court was whether this lawsuit could proceed as a class action. And here's the nub of the dispute. Under New York law, litigants may not bring class action lawsuits to recover penalties, such as the statutory interest that Allstate owed. So if Shady Grove had sued Allstate in state court in New York law would control and the case could not proceed as a class action. The question was whether the result should be different because Shady Grove had sued Allstate in a federal diversity court rather than state court. And this presents a classic Erie question. Do we apply the New York law that prohibits Shady Grove from using the class action device in this case, or do we ignore that part of New York's law and apply a different rule of decision? Now, it's become almost cliche for lawyers to say that the Erie Doctrine requires federal diversity courts to apply state law for substantive issues and federal law for procedural issues. But that's an imprecise paraphrase, and it often creates more confusion than clarity. It's better, in my view, to start with a text of the Rules of Decision Act, which is codified at 28 U.S.C. Section 1652. Congress enacted this statute in the first Congress in 1789 in the original Judiciary Act. It's been on the books since the beginning of the Constitution. And Congress commands in this statute that, quote, the laws of the several states, except where the Constitution or treaties of the United States or acts of Congress otherwise require or provide, shall be regarded as rules of decision in civil actions in the courts of the United States in cases where they apply, end quote. Now, this formulation leaves some play in the joints. For example, what does the statute mean by the law of the several states? Does it include the state's common law, for example? What does the statute mean by rules of decision? Jurists and commentators have been debating these issues for more than a century. But for all the ambiguities in this statute, one thing is pellucid. When a valid federal statute or treaty or federal rule of civil procedure is sufficiently broad to control an issue, the federal diversity court must apply that federal law, and state law must give way. That's just a straightforward application of federal supremacy, which the Rules of Decision Act both acknowledges and affirms. The problem is, in many cases, it's far from clear whether a federal rule of civil procedure is in fact sufficiently broad to displace state law. Now, some cases are easy. Rule 26A, for example, in the federal rules, mandates that parties disclose liability insurance policies during discovery. That federal law command will conflict with and trump any state law rule that tries to protect those liability insurance policies from discovery. But hard cases can arise in two situations. First, a federal rule of civil procedure may govern an issue, but may not directly collide with relevant provisions of state law. So in these cases, it may be possible for a court to give effect to both the federal rule and the relevant state laws. Second, a federal rule of civil procedure will sometimes be narrowly construed to avoid problems under the Rules Enabling Act. The Rules Enabling Act is the statute that authorizes the Supreme Court justices to create the federal rules of civil procedure. But it specifies that these federal rules may not, quote, abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right, end quote. So any federal rule that violates this provision, this restriction on rules that abridge the substance of state law, is invalid. And in previous decisions, the Supreme Court has narrowly construed provisions in the federal rules to avoid displacing substantive state law rights, because otherwise the justices might be compelled to invalidate a federal rule under the Rules Enabling Act. And nothing could be more embarrassing for the Supreme Court justices than to invalidate a provision of the federal rules that they themselves had earlier approved, essentially confessing that they had exceeded the boundaries of their statutory powers, but they just didn't realize it at the time. So that's the doctrinal background. Let's move on to the legal arguments that were advanced in Shady Grove. Shady Grove Orthopedics wanted to bring this case as a class action in federal court. And to do that, it needed to get around the provision of New York law saying that it couldn't bring this as a class action. Shady Grove maintained that Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure conflicts with and trumps the New York law. And what Rule 23 says is that a class action, quote, may be maintained, end quote, in cases that satisfy Rule 23's criteria for class actions. Shady Grove argued that this directly conflicts with the New York law, which says that class actions seeking statutory penalties, quote, may not be maintained, end quote, even when they would satisfy Rule 23's criteria. So on the text alone, that appears to be as clear a conflict between a federal and state law as one could imagine. The federal law says may be maintained, and a state statute says may not be maintained. One or the other must give way. And in our system, state law must yield when it runs headlong into a valid federal enactment. And that was the majority opinion's conclusion. The Supreme Court, per Justice Scalia, held that Rule 23 entitled Shady Grove to bring this class action in federal court so long as Shady Grove could satisfy the criteria in Rule 23. New York's categorical prohibition on penalty class actions could not prevail in the teeth of Rule 23's may be maintained language. So the court remanded the case to allow the district court to determine whether Shady Grove could in fact satisfy Rule 23's criteria. Now, Justice Ginsburg's dissenting opinion thought that Rule 23 should be more narrowly construed, but it didn't meet the majority opinion's textual argument. Instead, Justice Ginsburg discussed the legislative history of the New York statute. She invoked some earlier Supreme Court decisions that narrowly construed ambiguous provisions in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to avoid displacing a state's laws. But the dissent relied primarily on purposivism and background norms of federalism, rather than attempting to analyze or explain how New York's law could coexist with the actual language in Rule 23. So it's unsurprising that these arguments were unable to sway the court's more textualist justices, Justices Scalia and Thomas, as well as Chief Justice Roberts. So what are the implications of the court's ruling? Well, first, the court was unwilling to bend the language of a federal rule of civil procedure simply to avoid displacing state law. And that's significant because in several previous cases, the Supreme Court has adopted strained and sometimes indefensible interpretations of federal statutory language in order to preserve values of federalism. Not in this case. The majority just gave a straightforward construction to Rule 23 without putting any state rights thumb on the scales. This could be a useful precedent for litigants arguing against doctrines, such as the presumption against preemption, or the canon of constitutional avoidance, or some of the clear statement rules that the justices will, from time to time, impose. Second, Shady Grove should be easy to distinguish in future Erie cases. This was a rare case in which the state statute ran headlong into the text of a federal rule. As I mentioned earlier, Rule 23 contains the words, may be maintained, while the New York statute said, may not be maintained. Few Erie cases involve such directly conflicting language. So litigants may still have room to argue for construing other provisions in the federal rules narrowly and with sensitivity to state laws and policies. Finally, the Shady Grove ruling has important implications for forum shopping strategies and class action litigation. As a general matter, plaintiff attorneys prefer to litigate class actions in state court, while defense attorneys generally prefer federal court. Federal judges are perceived as more pro-business. Jury pools in federal courts are drawn from larger geographic regions, which helps mitigate risks to defendants. And over the past decade, Congress, in response to pressure from business interests, has enacted legislation that expands federal subject matter jurisdiction in class action controversies. Well, Shady Grove shows that sometimes class action defendants will be better off in state court. And that's because some states, like New York, will have class action certification laws that are more restrictive than Rule 23. And Shady Grove makes clear that Rule 23's more generous certification rules will govern whenever a class action is litigated in federal court, even when the class is pursuing state law claims. So don't always assume that if you represent a class action defendant, you'll want to be in federal court. Often you will, but Shady Grove is an important wrinkle to keep in mind. This is Jonathan Mitchell, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.